Chapter 85.
The Holy Vatican grottos are located beneath the main floor of St. Peter's Basilica. They are the burial place of deceased popes. Vittoria reached the bottom of the spiral staircase and entered the grotto. The darkened tunnel reminded her of CERN's Large Hadron Collider, black and cold. Lit now only by the flashlights of the Swiss guards, the tunnel carried a distinctly incorporeal feel. On both sides, hollow niches lined the wall. Recessed in the alcoves, as far as lights let them see, the hulking shadows of sarcophagi loomed. An iciness raked her flesh. "It's the cold," she told herself, knowing that was only partially true. She had the sense they were being watched, not by anyone in the flesh, but by specters in the dark. On top of each tomb, in full papal vestments, lay life-sized semblances of each pope, shown in death, arms folded across their chests. The prostrate bodies seemed to emerge from within the tombs, pressing upward against the marble lids as if trying to escape their mortal restraints. The flashlight procession moved on, and the papal silhouettes rose and fell against the walls, stretching and vanishing in a macabre shadowbox dance. A silence had fallen across the group, and Vittoria couldn't tell whether it was one of respect or apprehension. She sensed both. The Camerlengo moved with his eyes closed, as if he knew every step by heart. Vittoria suspected he had made this eerie promenade many times since the Pope's death, perhaps to pray at his tomb for guidance. "I worked under the cardinal's tutelage for many years," the Camerlengo had said. "He was like a father to me." Vittoria recalled the Camerlengo speaking those words in reference to the cardinal who had saved him from the army. Now, however, Vittoria understood the rest of the story. That very cardinal who had taken the Camerlengo under his wing had apparently later risen to the papacy, and brought with him his young protégé to serve as chamberlain. "That explains a lot," Vittoria thought. She had always possessed a well-tuned perception for others' inner emotions, and something about the Camerlengo had been nagging her all day. Since meeting him, she had sensed an anguish more soulful and private than the overwhelming crisis he now faced. Behind his pious calm, she saw a man tormented by personal demons. Now she knew her instincts had been correct. Not only was he facing the most devastating threat in Vatican history, but he was doing it without his mentor and friend, flying solo. The guards slowed now, as if unsure where exactly in the darkness the most recent pope was buried. The Camerlengo continued assuredly and stopped before a marble tomb that seemed to glisten brighter than the others. Lying atop was a carved figure of the late pope. When Vittoria recognized his face from television, a shot of fear gripped her. "What are we doing?" "I realize we do not have much time," the Camerlengo said. "I still ask we take a moment of prayer." The Swiss guard all bowed their heads where they were standing. Vittoria followed suit, her heart pounding in the silence. The Camerlengo knelt before the tomb and prayed in Italian. As Vittoria listened to his words, an unexpected grief surfaced as tears. Tears for her own mentor, her own holy father. The Camerlengo's words seemed as appropriate for her father as they did for the Pope. "Supreme Father, Counselor, Friend," the Camerlengo's voice echoed dully around the ring. "You told me when I was young that the voice in my heart was that of God. You told me I must follow it, no matter what painful places it leads. I hear that voice now, asking of me impossible tasks. Give me strength. Bestow on me forgiveness. What I do in the name of everything you believe. Amen."
"Amen," the guards whispered.
"Amen, Father."
Vittoria wiped her eyes. The Camerlengo stood slowly and stepped away from the tomb.
"Push the covering aside."
The Swiss guards hesitated.
"Signore," one said,
"by law we are at your command."
He paused.
"We will do as you say."
The Camerlengo seemed to read the young man's mind. Someday I will ask your forgiveness for placing you in this position. Today, I ask for your obedience. Vatican laws are established to protect this church. It is in that very spirit that I command you to break them now. There was a moment of silence, and then the lead guard gave the order. The three men set down their flashlights on the floor, and their shadows leapt overhead. Lit now from beneath, the men advanced toward the tomb. Bracing their hands against the marble covering near the head of the tomb, they planted their feet and prepared to push. On signal, they all thrust, straining against the enormous slab. When the lid did not move at all, Vittoria found herself almost hoping it was too heavy. She was suddenly fearful of what they would find inside. The men pushed harder, and still the stone did not move. "Ancora," the Camerlengo said, rolling up the sleeves of his cassock and preparing to push along with them. "Ora," everyone heaved. Vittoria was about to offer her own help, but just then the lid began to slide. The men dug in again, and with an almost primal growl of stone on stone, the lid rotated off the top of the tomb and came to rest at an angle. The Pope's carved head now pushed back into the niche, and his feet extending out into the hallway. Everyone stepped back. Tentatively, a guard bent and retrieved his flashlight. Then he aimed it into the tomb. The beam seemed to tremble a moment, and then the guard held it steady. The other guards gathered one by one. Even in the darkness, Vittoria sensed them recoil. In succession, they crossed themselves. The Camerlengo shuddered when he looked into the tomb, his shoulders dropping like weights. He stood a long moment before turning away. Vittoria had feared the corpse's mouth might be clenched tight with rigor mortis, and that she would have to suggest breaking the jaw to see the tongue. Now she saw it would be unnecessary. The cheeks had collapsed, and the Pope's mouth gaped wide. His tongue was black as death. Chapter 86. No light, no sound. The secret archives were black. Fear, Langdon now realized, was an intense motivator. Short of breath, he fumbled through the blackness toward the revolving door. He found the button on the wall and rammed his palm against it. Nothing happened. He tried again. The door was dead. Spinning, blind, he called out, but his voice emerged strangled. The peril of his predicament suddenly closed in around him. His lungs strained for oxygen as the adrenaline doubled his heart rate. He felt like someone had just punched him in the gut. When he threw his weight into the door, for an instant he thought he felt the door start to turn. He pushed again, seeing stars. Now he realized it was the entire room turning, not the door. Staggering away, Langdon tripped over the base of a rolling ladder and fell hard. He tore his knee against the edge of a bookstack. Swearing, he got up and groped for the ladder. He found it. He had hoped it would be heavy wood or iron, but it was aluminum. He grabbed the ladder and held it like a battering ram. Then he ran through the dark at the glass wall. It was closer than he thought. The ladder hit head-on, bouncing off. From the feeble sound of the collision, Langdon knew he was going to need a hell of a lot more than an aluminum ladder to break this glass. When he flashed on the semi-automatic, his hope surged and then instantly fell. The weapon was gone. Olivetti had relieved him of it in the Pope's office, saying he didn't want loaded weapons around with a Camerlengo present. It made sense at the time. Langdon called out again, making less sound than the last time. Next, he remembered the walkie-talkie the guard had left on the table outside the vault. Why the hell didn't I bring it in? As the purple stars began to dance before his eyes, Langdon forced himself to think. You've been trapped before, he told himself. You survived worse. You were just a kid and you figured it out. The crushing darkness came flooding in. Think! Langdon lowered himself onto the floor. He rolled over on his back and laid his hands at his sides. The first step was to gain control. Relax. Conserve. No longer fighting gravity to pump blood, Langdon's heart began to slow. It was a trick swimmers used to re-oxygenate their blood between tightly scheduled races.
"There is plenty of air in here," he told himself. "Plenty. Now think."
He waited, half expecting the lights to come back on at any moment. They didn't. As he lay there, able to breathe better now, an eerie resignation came across him. He felt peaceful. He fought it. "You will move, damn it. But where?"
On Langdon's wrist, Mickey Mouse glowed happily, as if enjoying the dark. 9:33 p.m., half an hour until fire. Langdon thought it felt a whole hell of a lot later. His mind, instead of coming up with a plan for escape, was suddenly demanding an explanation.
Who turned off the power? Was Roche expanding his search? Wouldn't Olivetti have warned Roche that I'm in here?
Langdon knew at this point it made no difference. Opening his mouth wide and tipping back his head, Langdon pulled the deepest breaths he could manage. Each breath burned a little less than the last. His head cleared. He reeled his thoughts in and forced the gears into motion.
"Glass walls," he told himself, "but damn thick glass."
He wondered if any of the books in here were stored in heavy, steel, fireproof file cabinets. Langdon had seen them from time to time in other archives, but had seen none here. Besides, finding one in the dark could prove time-consuming. Not that he could lift one anyway, particularly in his present state.
How about the examination table?
Langdon knew this vault, like the other, had an examination table in the center of the stacks.
So what?
He knew he couldn't lift it. Not to mention, even if he could drag it, he wouldn't get it far. The stacks were closely packed, the aisles between them far too narrow.
The aisles are too narrow.
Suddenly, Langdon knew. With a burst of confidence, he jumped to his feet far too fast. Swaying in the fog of a head rush, he reached out in the dark for support. His hand found a stack. Waiting a moment, he forced himself to conserve. He would need all of his strength to do this. Positioning himself against the book stack like a football player against a training sled, he planted his feet and pushed. "If I can somehow tip the shelf..." But it barely moved. He realigned and pushed again. His feet slipped backward on the floor. The stack creaked, but didn't move. He needed leverage. Finding the glass wall again, he placed one hand on it to guide him as he raced in the dark toward the far end of the vault. The back wall loomed suddenly, and he collided with it, crushing his shoulder. Cursing, Langdon circled the shelf and grabbed the stack at about eye level. Then, propping one leg on the glass behind him and another on the lower shelves, he started to climb. Books fell around him, fluttering into the darkness. He didn't care. Instinct for survival had long since overridden archival decorum. He sensed his equilibrium was hampered by the total darkness and closed his eyes, coaxing his brain to ignore visual input. He moved faster now. The air felt leaner the higher he went. He scrambled toward the upper shelves, stepping on books, trying to gain purchase, heaving himself upward. Then, like a rock climber conquering a rock face, Langdon grasped the top shelf. Stretching his legs out behind him, he walked his feet up the glass wall until he was almost horizontal.
"Now or never, Robert," a voice urged. "Just like the leg press in the Harvard gym."
With dizzying exertion, he planted his feet against the wall behind him, braced his arms and chest against the stack, and pushed. Nothing happened. Fighting for air, he repositioned and tried again, extending his legs. Ever so slightly, the stack moved. He pushed again, and the stack rocked forward an inch or two, and then back. Langdon took advantage of the motion, inhaling what felt like oxygenless breath, and heaving again. The shelf rocked farther.
"Like a swing set," he told himself. "Keep the rhythm. A little more."
Langdon rocked the shelf, extending his legs farther with each push. His quadriceps burned now, and he blocked the pain. The pendulum was in motion. "Three more pushes," he urged himself. It only took two. There was an instant of weightless uncertainty. Then, with a thundering of books sliding off the shelves, Langdon and the shelf were falling forward. Halfway to the ground, the shelf hit the stack next to it. Langdon hung on, throwing his weight forward, urging the second shelf to topple. There was a moment of motionless panic, and then, creaking under the weight, the second stack began to tip. Langdon was falling again. Like enormous dominoes, the stacks began to topple one after another. Metal on metal, books tumbling everywhere. Langdon held on as his inclined stack bounced downward like a ratchet on a jack. He wondered how many stacks there were in all. How much would they weigh? The glass at the far end was thick. Langdon's stack had fallen almost to the horizontal when he heard what he was waiting for, a different kind of collision. Far off, at the end of the vault, the sharp smack of metal on glass. The vault around him shook, and Langdon knew the final stack, weighted down by the others, had hit the glass hard. The sound that followed was the most unwelcome sound Langdon had ever heard. Silence. There was no crashing of glass, only the resounding thud as the wall accepted the weight of the stacks now propped against it. He lay wide-eyed on the pile of books. Somewhere in the distance there was a creaking. Langdon would have held his breath to listen, but he had none left to hold. 1 second, two. Then, as he teetered on the brink of unconsciousness, Langdon heard a distant yielding, a ripple spidering outward through the glass. Suddenly, like a cannon, the glass exploded. The stack beneath Langdon collapsed to the floor. Like welcome rain on a desert, shards of glass tinkled downward in the dark. With a great sucking hiss, the air gushed in. 30 seconds later, in the Vatican grottos, Vittoria was standing before a corpse when the electronic squawk of a walkie-talkie broke the silence. The voice blaring out sounded short of breath.
"This is Robert Langdon. Can anyone hear me?"
Vittoria looked up.
"Robert!" She couldn't believe how much she suddenly wished he were there.
The guards exchanged puzzled looks. One took a radio off his belt.
"Mr. Langdon, you're on Channel 3. The commander is waiting to hear from you on Channel 1. "I know he's on Channel 1, damn it. I don't want to speak to him. I want the Camerlengo. Now! Somebody find him for me."
In the obscurity of the secret archives, Langdon stood amidst shattered glass and tried to catch his breath. He felt a warm liquid on his left hand and knew he was bleeding. The Camerlengo's voice spoke at once, startling Langdon.
"This is Camerlengo Ventresca. What's going on?"
Langdon pressed the button, his heart still pounding.
"I think somebody just tried to kill me."
There was a silence on the line. Langdon tried to calm himself.
"I also know where the next killing is going to be."
The voice that came back was not the Camerlengo's. It was Commander Olivetti's.
"Mr. Langdon, do not speak another word."
Chapter 87.
Langdon's watch, now smeared with blood, read 9:41 p.m. as he ran across the courtyard of the Belvedere and approached the fountain outside the Swiss Guard Security Center. His hand had stopped bleeding and now felt worse than it looked. As he arrived, it seemed everyone convened at once. Olivetti, Rocher, the Camerlengo, Vittoria, and a handful of guards. Vittoria hurried toward him immediately.
"Robert, you're hurt!"
Before Langdon could answer, Olivetti was before him.
"Mr. Langdon, I'm relieved you're okay. I'm sorry about the crossed signals in the archives." "Crossed signals?" Langdon demanded. "You knew damn well." "It was my fault,"
Rocher said, stepping forward, sounding contrite.
"I had no idea you were in the archives. Portions of our white zones are cross-wired with that building. We were extending our search. I'm the one who killed Power. If I had known..."
"Robert," Vittoria said, taking his wounded hand in hers and looking it over.
"The Pope was poisoned. The Illuminati killed him."
Langdon heard the words, but they barely registered. He was saturated. All he could feel was the warmth of Vittoria's hands.
The Camerlengo pulled a silk handkerchief from his cassock and handed it to Langdon so he could clean himself. The man said nothing. His green eyes seemed filled with a new fire.
"Robert," Vittoria pressed, "you said you found where the next cardinal is going to be killed?"
Langdon felt flighty.
"I do. It's at the..."
"No," Olivetti interrupted. "Mr. Langdon, when I asked you not to speak another word on the walkie-talkie, it was for a reason." He turned to the handful of assembled Swiss guards. "Excuse us, gentlemen." The soldiers disappeared into the security center. No indignity, only compliance. Olivetti turned back to the remaining group. "As much as it pains me to say this, the murder of our Pope is an act that could have only been accomplished with help from within these walls. For the good of all, we can trust no one, including our guards." He seemed to be suffering as he spoke the words. Rocher looked anxious.
"Inside collusion implies..."
"Yes," Olivetti said. "The integrity of your search is compromised. And yet it is a gamble we must take. Keep looking." Rocher looked like he was about to say something, thought better of it, and left. The Camerlengo inhaled deeply. He had not said a word yet, and Langdon sensed a new rigor in the man, as if a turning point had been reached.
"Commander."
The Camerlengo's tone was impermeable. "I am going to break conclave." Olivetti pursed his lips, looking dour.
"I advise against it. We still have 2 hours and 20 minutes. "A heartbeat."
Olivetti's tone was now challenging.
"What do you intend to do? Evacuate the cardinal single-handedly?" "I intend to save this church with whatever power God has given me. How I proceed is no longer your concern."
Olivetti straightened.
"Whatever you intend to do..." He paused. "I do not have the authority to restrain you, particularly in light of my apparent failure as head of security. I ask only that you wait. Wait 20 minutes, until after 10 o'clock. If Mr. Langdon's information is correct, I may still have a chance to catch this assassin. There is still a chance to preserve protocol and decorum."
"Decorum!" The Camerlengo let out a choked laugh.
"We have long since passed propriety, Commander. In case you hadn't noticed, this is war."
A guard emerged from the security center and called out to the Camerlengo.
"Signore, I just got word. We have detained the BBC reporter, Mr. Glick."
The Camerlengo nodded. "Have both he and his camerawoman meet me outside the Sistine Chapel." Olivetti's eyes widened.
"What are you doing?"
20 minutes, Commander. That's all I'm giving you." Then he was gone. When Olivetti's Alfa Romeo tore out of Vatican City, this time there was no line of unmarked cars following him. In the back seat, Vittoria bandaged Langdon's hand with a first aid kit she'd found in the glove box. Olivetti stared straight ahead.
"Okay, Mr. Langdon, where are we going?"
Chapter 88. Even with its siren now affixed and blaring, Olivetti's Alfa Romeo seemed to go unnoticed as it rocketed across the bridge into the heart of old Rome. All the traffic was moving in the other direction, toward the Vatican, as if the Holy See had suddenly become the hottest entertainment in Rome. Langdon sat in the back seat, the questions whipping through his mind. He wondered about the killer, if they would catch him this time. If he would tell them what they needed to know, if it was already too late. How long before the Camerlengo told the crowd in St. Peter's Square they were in danger? The incident in the vault still nagged. A mistake. Olivetti never touched the brakes as he snaked the howling Alfa Romeo toward the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria. Langdon knew on any other day his knuckles would have been white. At the moment, however, he felt anesthetized. Only the throbbing in his hand reminded him where he was. Overhead, the siren wailed. Nothing like telling them we're coming, Langdon thought. And yet they were making incredible time. He guessed Olivetti would kill the siren as they drew nearer. Now, with a moment to sit and reflect, Langdon felt a tinge of amazement as the news of the Pope's murder finally registered in his mind. The thought was inconceivable, and yet somehow it seemed a perfectly logical event. Infiltration had always been the Illuminati power base, rearrangements of power from within. And it was not as if popes had never been murdered. Countless rumors of treachery abounded, although with no autopsy, none was ever confirmed. Until recently. Academics not long ago had gotten permission to x-ray the tomb of Pope Celestine V, who had allegedly died at the hands of his overeager successor, Boniface VIII. The researchers had hoped the x-ray might reveal some small hint of foul play, a broken bone, perhaps. Incredibly, the x-ray had revealed a 10-inch nail driven into the Pope's skull. Langdon now recalled a series of news clippings fellow Illuminati buffs had sent him years ago. At first he had thought the clippings were a prank, so he'd gone to the Harvard microfiche collection to confirm the articles were authentic. Incredibly, they were. He now kept them on his bulletin board as examples of how even respectable news organizations sometimes got carried away with Illuminati paranoia. Suddenly, the media's suspicions seemed a lot less paranoid. Langdon could see the articles clearly in his mind. The British Broadcasting Corporation, June 14, 1998. Pope John Paul I, who died in 1978, fell victim to a plot by the P2 Masonic Lodge. The secret society, P2, decided to murder John Paul I when it saw he was determined to dismiss the American Archbishop Paul Marcinkus as president of the Vatican Bank. The bank had been implicated in shady financial dealings with the Masonic Lodge. The New York Times, August 24, 1998. Why was the late John Paul I wearing his day shirt in bed? Why was it torn? The questions don't stop there. No medical investigations were made. Cardinal Vio forbade an autopsy on the grounds that no pope was ever given a post-mortem. And John Paul's medicines mysteriously vanished from his bedside, as did his glasses, slippers, and his last will and testament. London Daily Mail, August 27, 1998. A plot including a powerful, ruthless, and illegal Masonic lodge with tentacles stretching into the Vatican. The cellular in Vittoria's pocket rang, thankfully erasing the memories from Langdon's mind. Vittoria answered, looking confused as to who might be calling her. Even from a few feet away, Langdon recognized the laser-like voice on the phone.
"Vittoria, this is Maximilian Kohler. Have you found the antimatter yet?"
"Max, you're okay?"
"I saw the news. There was no mention of CERN or the antimatter. This is good. What is happening?"
"We haven't located the canister yet. The situation is complex. Robert Langdon has been quite an asset. We have a lead on catching the man assassinating cardinals. Right now we're headed..."
"Miss Vetra," Olivetti interrupted, "you've said enough."
She covered the receiver, clearly annoyed. "Commander, this is the president of CERN. Certainly he has a right to..."
"He has a right," Olivetti snapped, "to be here, handling the situation. You're on an open cellular line. You've said enough."
Vittoria took a deep breath.
"Max."
"I may have some information for you," Max said, "about your father. I may know who he told about the antimatter."
Vittoria's expression clouded. "Max, my father said he told no one."
"I'm afraid, Vittoria, your father did tell someone. I need to check some security records. I will be in touch soon."
The line went dead. Vittoria looked waxen as she returned the phone to her pocket. "You okay?" Langdon asked. Vittoria nodded, her trembling fingers revealing the lie.
"The church is on Piazza Barberini," Olivetti said, killing the siren and checking his watch. "We have 9 minutes."
When Langdon had first realized the location of the third marker, the position of the church had rung some distant bell for him. Piazza Barberini. Something about the name was familiar. Something he couldn't place. Now Langdon realized what it was. The piazza was the site of a controversial subway stop. 20 years ago, construction of the subway terminal had created a stir among art historians, who feared digging beneath Piazza Barberini might topple the multi-ton obelisk that stood in the center. City planners had removed the obelisk and replaced it with a small fountain called the Triton. In Bernini's day, Langdon now realized, Piazza Barberini had contained an obelisk. Whatever doubts Langdon had felt that this was the location of the third marker now totally evaporated. A block from the piazza, Olivetti turned into an alley, gunned the car halfway down, and skidded to a stop. He pulled off his suit jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and loaded his weapon.
"We can't risk your being recognized," he said. "You two were on television. I want you across the piazza, out of sight, watching the front entrance. I'm going in the back."
He produced a familiar pistol and handed it to Langdon.
"Just in case."
Langdon frowned. It was the second time today he had been handed a gun. He slid it into his breast pocket. As he did, he realized he was still carrying the folio from Diagramma. He couldn't believe he had forgotten to leave it behind. He pictured the Vatican curator collapsing in spasms of outrage at the thought of this priceless artifact being packed around Rome like some tourist map. Then Langdon thought of the mess of shattered glass and strewn documents that he'd left behind in the archives. The curator had other problems, if the archives even survived the night. Olivetti got out of the car and motioned back up the alley.
"The piazza is that way. Keep your eyes open and don't let yourselves be seen."
He tapped the phone on his belt.
"Miss Vetra, let's retest our autodial."
Vittoria removed her phone and hit the autodial number she and Olivetti had programmed at the Pantheon. Olivetti's phone vibrated in silent ring mode on his belt. The commander nodded.
"Good. If you see anything, I want to know."
He cocked his weapon.
"I'll be inside waiting. This heathen is mine."
At that moment, very nearby, another cellular phone was ringing. The Hashashin answered.
"Speak."
"It is I," the voice said. "Janus."
The Hashashin smiled.
"Hello, master."
"Your position may be known. Someone is coming to stop you."
"They are too late. I've already made the arrangements here."
"Good. Make sure you escape alive. There is work yet to be done."
"Those who stand in my way will die."
"Those who stand in your way are knowledgeable."
"You speak of an American scholar?"
"You are aware of him?"
The Hashashin chuckled.
"Cool-tempered, but naive. He spoke to me on the phone earlier. He's with a female who seems quite the opposite."
The killer felt a stirring of arousal as he recalled the fiery temperament of Leonardo Vetra's daughter. There was a momentary silence on the line, the first hesitation the Hashashin had ever sensed from his Illuminati master. Finally, Janus spoke.
"Eliminate them, if need be."
The killer smiled.
"Consider it done."
He felt a warm anticipation spreading through his body.
"Although the woman I may keep as a prize."
Chapter 89. War had broken out in St. Peter's Square. The piazza had exploded into a frenzy of aggression. Media trucks skidded into place like assault vehicles claiming beachheads. Reporters unfurled high-tech electronics like soldiers arming for battle. All around the perimeter of the square, networks jockeyed for positions as they raced to erect the newest weapon in media wars, flat-screen displays. Flat-screen displays were enormous video screens that could be assembled on top of trucks or portable scaffolding. The screen served as a kind of billboard advertisement for the network, broadcasting that network's coverage and corporate logo like a drive-in movie. If a screen were well situated, in front of the action, for example, a competing network couldn't shoot the story without including an advertisement for their competitor. The square was quickly becoming not only a multimedia extravaganza, but a frenzied public vigil. Onlookers poured in from all directions. Open space in the usually limitless square was fast becoming a valuable commodity. People clustered around the towering flat-screen displays, listening to live reports in stunned excitement. Only 100 yards away, inside the thick walls of St. Peter's Basilica, the world was serene. Lieutenant Chartrand and 3 other guards moved through the darkness. Wearing their infrared goggles, they fanned out across the nave, swinging their detectors before them. The search of Vatican City's public access areas so far had yielded nothing. "Better remove your goggles up here," the senior guard said. Chartrand was already doing it. They were nearing the niche of the paliums, the sunken area in the center of the basilica. It was lit by 99 oil lamps, and the amplified infrared would have seared their eyes. Chartrand enjoyed being out of the heavy goggles, and he stretched his neck as they descended into the sunken niche to scan the area. The room was beautiful, golden and glowing. He had not been down here yet. It seemed every day since Chartrand had arrived in Vatican City, he had learned some new Vatican mystery. These oil lamps were one of them. There were exactly 99 lamps burning at all times. It was a tradition. The clergy vigilantly refilled the lamps with sacred oils, such that no lamp ever burned out. It was said they would burn until the end of time. Or at least until midnight, Chartrand thought, feeling his mouth go dry again. Chartrand swung his detector over the oil lamps. Nothing hidden in here. He wasn't surprised. The canister, according to the video feed, was hidden in a dark area. As he moved across the niche, he came to a bulkhead grate covering a hole in the floor. The hole led to a steep and narrow stairway that went straight down. He had heard stories about what lay down there. Thankfully, they wouldn't have to descend. Rocher's orders were clear. Search only the public access areas. Ignore the white zones. "What's that smell?" he asked, turning away from the grate. The niche smelled intoxicatingly sweet. "Fumes from the lamps," one of them replied. Chartrand was surprised. "Smells more like cologne than kerosene." "It's not kerosene. These lamps are close to the papal altar, so they take a special ambiental mixture. Ethanol, sugar, butane, and perfume." "Butane?" Chartrand eyed the lamps uneasily. The guard nodded. "Don't spill any. Smells like heaven, but burns like hell." The guards had completed searching the niche of the paliums and were moving across the basilica again when their walkie-talkies went off. It was an update. The guards listened in shock. Apparently there were troubling new developments, which could not be shared on air, but the Camerlengo had decided to break tradition and enter conclave to address the cardinals. Never before in history had this been done. Then again, Chartrand realized, never before in history had the Vatican been sitting on what amounted to some sort of neoteric nuclear warhead. Chartrand felt comforted to know the Camerlengo was taking control. The Camerlengo was the person inside Vatican City for whom Chartrand held the most respect. Some of the guards thought of the Camerlengo as a beato, a religious zealot whose love of God bordered on obsession. But even they agreed. When it came to fighting the enemies of God, the Camerlengo was the one man who would stand up and play hardball. The Swiss guards had seen a lot of the Camerlengo this week in preparation for conclave, and everyone had commented that the man seemed a bit rough around the edges, his verdant eyes a bit more intense than usual. Not surprisingly, they all commented, not only was the Camerlengo responsible for planning the sacred conclave, but he had to do it immediately on the heels of the loss of his mentor, the Pope. Chartrand had only been at the Vatican a few months when he heard the story of the bomb that blew up the Camerlengo's mother before the kid's very eyes. A bomb in church, and now it's happening all over again. Sadly, the authorities never caught the bastards who planted the bomb. Probably some anti-Christian hate group, they said, and the case faded away. No wonder the Camerlengo despised apathy. A couple months back, on a peaceful afternoon inside Vatican City, Chartrand had bumped into the Camerlengo coming across the grounds. The Camerlengo had apparently recognized Chartrand as a new guard and invited him to accompany him on a stroll. They had talked about nothing in particular, and the Camerlengo made Chartrand feel immediately at home.
"Father," Chartrand said, "may I ask you a strange question?"
The Camerlengo smiled.
"Only if I may give you a strange answer."
Chartrand laughed.
"I have asked every priest I know, and I still don't understand."
"What troubles you?" The Camerlengo led the way in short, quick strides, his frock kicking out in front of him as he walked. His black, crepe-sole shoes seemed befitting, Chartrand thought, like reflections of the man's essence, modern but humble, and showing signs of wear. Chartrand took a deep breath.
"I don't understand this omnipotent, benevolent thing."
The Camerlengo smiled.
"You've been reading scripture."
"I try." "You are confused because the Bible describes God as an omnipotent and benevolent deity."
"Exactly."
"Omnipotent benevolence simply means that God is all-powerful and well-meaning."
"I understand the concept. It's just, there seems to be a contradiction."
"Yes. The contradiction is pain. Man's starvation, war, sickness."
"Exactly."
Chartrand knew the Camerlengo would understand.
"Terrible things happen in this world. Human tragedy seems like proof that God could not possibly be both all-powerful and well-meaning. If he loves us and has the power to change our situation, he would prevent our pain, wouldn't he?"
The Camerlengo frowned.
"Would he?"
Chartrand felt uneasy. Had he overstepped his bounds? Was this one of those religious questions you just didn't ask?
"Well, if God loves us and he can protect us, he would have to. It seems he is either omnipotent and uncaring, or benevolent and powerless to help."
"Do you have children, Lieutenant?"
Chartrand flushed. "No, Signore."
"Imagine you had an 8-year-old son. Would you love him?"
"Of course."
"Would you do everything in your power to prevent pain in his life?"
"Of course."
"Would you let him skateboard?" Chartrand did a double take. The Camerlengo always seemed oddly in touch for a clergyman.
"Yeah, I guess," Chartrand said. "Sure, I'd let him skateboard, but I'd tell him to be careful."
"So, as this child's father, you would give him some basic, good advice, and then let him go off and make his own mistakes?"
"I wouldn't run behind him and mollycoddle him, if that's what you mean."
"But what if he fell and skinned his knee?"
"He would learn to be more careful."
The Camerlengo smiled. "So, although you have the power to interfere and prevent your child's pain, you would choose to show your love by letting him learn his own lessons?"
"Of course. Pain is part of growing up. That's how we learn."
The Camerlengo nodded.
"Exactly."
Chapter 90. Langdon and Vittoria observed Piazza Barberini from the shadows of a small alleyway on the western corner. The church was opposite them, a hazy cupola emerging from a faint cluster of buildings across the square. The night had brought with it a welcome cool, and Langdon was surprised to find the square deserted. Above them, through open windows, blaring televisions reminded Langdon where everyone had disappeared to. "No comment yet from the Vatican. Illuminati murders of 2 cardinals. Satanic presence in Rome. Speculation about further infiltration." The news had spread like Nero's fire. Rome sat riveted, as did the rest of the world. Langdon wondered if they would really be able to stop this runaway train. As he scanned the piazza and waited, Langdon realized that despite the encroachment of modern buildings, the piazza still looked remarkably elliptical. High above, like some sort of modern shrine to a bygone hero, an enormous neon sign blinked on the roof of a luxurious hotel. Vittoria had already pointed it out to Langdon. The sign seemed eerily befitting. Hotel Bernini.
5 of 10, Vittoria said, cat eyes darting around the square. No sooner had she spoken the words than she grabbed Langdon's arm and pulled him back into the shadows. She motioned into the center of the square. Langdon followed her gaze. When he saw it, he stiffened. Crossing in front of them, beneath a street lamp, two dark figures appeared. Both were cloaked, their heads covered with dark mantles, the traditional black covering of Catholic widows. Langdon would have guessed they were women, but he couldn't be sure in the dark. One looked elderly and moved as if in pain, hunched over. The other, larger and stronger, was helping.
"Give me the gun," Vittoria said.
"You can't just..." Fluid as a cat, Vittoria was in and out of his pocket once again. The gun glinted in her hand. Then, in absolute silence, as if her feet never touched the cobblestone, she was circling left in the shadows, arcing across the square to approach the couple from the rear. Langdon stood transfixed as Vittoria disappeared. Then, swearing to himself, he hurried after her. The couple was moving slowly, and it was only a matter of half a minute before Langdon and Vittoria were positioned behind them, closing in from the rear. Vittoria concealed the gun beneath casually crossed arms in front of her, out of sight but accessible in a flash. She seemed to float faster and faster as the gap lessened, and Langdon battled to keep up. When his shoes scuffed a stone and sent it skittering, Vittoria shot him a sideways glare. But the couple didn't seem to hear. They were talking. At 30 feet, Langdon could start to hear voices. No words, just faint murmurings. Beside him, Vittoria moved faster with every step. Her arms loosened before her. The gun started to peek out. 20 feet. The voices were clearer, one much louder than the other. Angry, ranting. Langdon sensed it was the voice of an old woman, gruff, androgynous. He strained to hear what she was saying, but another voice cut the night.
"Mi scusi."
Vittoria's friendly tone lit the square like a torch. Langdon tensed as the cloaked couple stopped short and began to turn. Vittoria kept striding toward them, even faster now, on a collision course. They would have no time to react. Langdon realized his own feet had stopped moving. From behind, he saw Vittoria's arms loosening, her hand coming free, the gun swinging forward. Then, over her shoulder, he saw a face, lit now in the street lamp. The panic surged to his legs, and he lunged forward. "Vittoria, no!" Vittoria, however, seemed to exist a split second ahead of him. In a motion as swift as it was casual, Vittoria's arms were raised again, the gun disappearing as she clutched herself like a woman on a chilly night. Langdon stumbled to her side, almost colliding with the cloaked couple before them.
"Buonasera,"
Vittoria blurted, her voice startled with retreat. Langdon exhaled in relief. The two elderly women stood before them, scowling out from beneath their mantles. One was so old she could barely stand. The other was helping her. Both clutched rosaries. They seemed confused by the sudden interruption. Vittoria smiled, although she looked shaken.
"Dove la chiesa Santa Maria della Vittoria?"
"Where is the church of..." The two women motioned in unison to a bulky silhouette of a building on an inclined street from the direction they had come.
"E là."
"Grazie," Langdon said, putting his hands on Vittoria's shoulders and gently pulling her back. He couldn't believe they'd almost attacked a pair of old ladies.
"Non si può entrare,"
one woman warned.
"I chiesa temprano."
"Closed early?" Vittoria looked surprised.
"Perché?"
Both women explained at once. They sounded irate. Langdon understood only parts of the grumbling Italian. Apparently the women had been inside the church 15 minutes ago praying for the Vatican in its time of need, when some man had appeared and told them the church was closing early.
"Hanno conosciuto l'uomo?"
Vittoria demanded, sounding tense. "Did you know the man?" The women shook their heads. The man was a straniero crudo, they explained, and he had forcibly made everyone inside leave, even the young priest and janitor, who said they were calling the police. But the intruder had only laughed, telling them to be sure the police brought cameras.
cameras? Langdon wondered. The women clucked angrily and called the man a Bararabo. Then, grumbling, they continued on their way. Bararabo? Langdon asked Vittoria. A barbarian? Vittoria looked suddenly taut.
Not quite. Bararabo is derogatory wordplay. It means Arabo, Arab.
Langdon felt a shiver and turned toward the outline of the church. As he did, his eyes glimpsed something in the church's stained-glass windows. The image shot dread through his body. Unaware, Vittoria removed her cell phone and pressed the auto-dial.
I'm warning Olivetti.
Speechless, Langdon reached out and touched her arm. With a tremulous hand, he pointed to the church. Vittoria let out a gasp. Inside the building, glowing like evil eyes through the stained-glass windows, shone the growing flash of flames. Chapter 91 Langdon and Vittoria dashed to the main entrance of the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria and found the wooden door locked. Vittoria fired three shots from Olivetti's semi-automatic into the ancient bolt, and it shattered. The church had no anteroom, so the entirety of the sanctuary spread out in one gasping sweep as Langdon and Vittoria threw open the main door. The scene before them was so unexpected, so bizarre, that Langdon had to close his eyes and reopen them before his mind could take it all in. The church was lavish, baroque, gilded walls and altars. Dead center of the sanctuary, beneath the main cupola, wooden pews had been stacked high and were now ablaze in some sort of epic funeral pyre, a bonfire shooting high into the dome. As Langdon's eyes followed the inferno upward, the true horror of the scene descended like a bird of prey. High overhead, from the left and right sides of the ceiling, hung two incensor cables, lines used for swinging frankincense vessels above the congregation. These lines, however, carried no incensers now, nor were they swinging. They had been used for something else. Suspended from the cables was a human being, a naked man. Each wrist had been connected to an opposing cable, and he had been hoisted almost to the point of being torn apart. His arms were outstretched in a spread eagle, as if he were nailed to some sort of invisible crucifix hovering within the house of God. Langdon felt paralyzed as he stared upward. A moment later, he witnessed the final abomination. The old man was alive, and he raised his head. A pair of terrified eyes gazed down in a silent plea for help. On the man's chest was a scorched emblem. He had been branded. Langdon couldn't see it clearly, but he had little doubt what the marking said. As the flames climbed higher, lapping at the man's feet, the victim let out a cry of pain, his body trembling. As if ignited by some unseen force, Langdon felt his body suddenly in motion, dashing down the main aisle toward the conflagration. His lungs filled with smoke as he closed in. 10 feet from the inferno, at a full sprint, Langdon hit a wall of heat. The skin on his face singed, and he fell back, shielding his eyes and landing hard on the marble floor. Staggering upright, he pressed forward again, hands raised in protection. Instantly he knew the fire was too hot. Moving back again, he scanned the chapel walls. A heavy tapestry, he thought. If I can somehow smother the... But he knew a tapestry was not to be found. This is a Baroque chapel, Robert, not some damn German castle. Think! He forced his eyes back to the suspended man. High above, smoke and flames swirled in the cupola. The incensor cables stretched outward from the man's wrists, rising to the ceiling where they passed through pulleys and descended again to metal cleats on either side of the church. Langdon looked over at one of the cleats. It was high on the wall, but he knew if he could get to it and loosen one of the lines, the tension would slacken and the man would swing wide of the fire. A sudden surge of flames crackled higher, and Langdon heard a piercing scream from above. The skin on the man's feet was starting to blister. The cardinal was being roasted alive. Langdon fixed his sights on the cleat and ran for it.
In the rear of the church, Vittoria clutched the back of a pew, trying to gather her senses. The image overhead was horrid. She forced her eyes away.
"Do something!"
She wondered where Olivetti was. Had he seen the Hashashin? Had he caught him? Where were they now? Vittoria moved forward to help Langdon, but as she did, a sound stopped her. The crackling of the flames was getting louder by the instant, but a second sound also cut the air. A metallic vibration. Nearby. The repetitive pulse seemed to emanate from the end of the pews to her left. It was a stark rattle, like the ringing of a phone, but stony and hard. She clutched the gun firmly and moved down the row of pews. The sound grew louder. On, off. A recurrent vibration. As she approached the end of the aisle, she sensed the sound was coming from the floor just around the corner at the end of the pews. As she moved forward, gun outstretched in her right hand, she realized she was also holding something in her left hand. Her cell phone. In her panic, she had forgotten that outside she had used it to dial the commander, setting off his phone's silent vibration feature as a warning. Vittoria raised her phone to her ear. It was still ringing. The commander had never answered. Suddenly, with rising fear, Vittoria sensed she knew what was making the sound. She stepped forward, trembling. The entire church seemed to sink beneath her feet as her eyes met the lifeless form on the floor. No stream of liquid flowed from the body. No signs of violence tattooed the flesh. There was only the fearful geometry of the commander's head, torqued backward, twisted 180 degrees in the wrong direction. Vittoria fought the images of her own father's mangled body. The phone on the commander's belt lay against the floor, vibrating over and over against the cold marble. Vittoria hung up her own phone, and the ringing stopped. In the silence, Vittoria heard a new sound, a breathing in the dark directly behind her. She started to spin, gun raised, but she knew she was too late. A laser beam of heat screamed from the top of her skull to the soles of her feet as the killer's elbow crashed down on the back of her neck.
"Now you are mine," a voice said.
Then everything went black. Across the sanctuary, on the left lateral wall, Langdon balanced atop a pew and scraped upward on the wall, trying to reach the cleat. The cable was still 6 feet above his head. Cleats like these were common in churches and were placed high to prevent tampering. Langdon knew priests used wooden ladders called puali to access the cleats. The killer had obviously used the church's ladder to hoist his victim, so where the hell is the ladder now? Langdon looked down, searching the floor around him. He had a faint recollection of seeing a ladder in here somewhere, but where? A moment later, his heart sank. He realized where he had seen it. He turned toward the raging fire. Sure enough, the ladder was high atop the blaze, engulfed in flames. Filled now with desperation, Langdon scanned the entire church from his raised platform, looking for anything at all that could help him reach the cleat. As his eyes probed the church, he had a sudden realization. Where the hell is Vittoria? She had disappeared. Did she go for help? Langdon screamed out her name, but there was no response. And where is Olivetti? There was a howl of pain from above, and Langdon sensed he was already too late. As his eyes went skyward again and saw the slowly roasting victim, Langdon had thoughts for only one thing. Water. Lots of it. Put out the fire. At least lower the flames. I need water, damn it! He yelled out loud.
That's next, a voice growled from the back of the church.
Langdon wheeled, almost falling off the pews. Striding up the side aisle directly toward him came a dark monster of a man. Even in the glow of the fire, his eyes burned black. Langdon recognized the gun in his hand as the one from his own jacket pocket, the one Vittoria had been carrying when they came in. The sudden wave of panic that rose in Langdon was a frenzy of disjunct fears. His initial instinct was for Vittoria. What had this animal done to her? Was she hurt? Or worse?
In the same instant, Langdon realized the man overhead was screaming louder. The Cardinal would die. Helping him now was impossible. Then, as the Hashashin leveled the gun at Langdon's chest, Langdon's panic turned inward, his senses on overload. He reacted on instinct as the shot went off. Launching off the bench, Langdon sailed arms first over the sea of church pews. When he hit the pews, he hit harder than he had imagined, immediately rolling to the floor. The marble cushioned his fall with all the grace of cold steel. Footsteps closed to his right. Langdon turned his body toward the front of the church and began scrambling for his life beneath the pews. High above the chapel floor, Cardinal Guidera endured his last torturous moments of consciousness. As he looked down the length of his naked body, he saw the skin on his legs begin to blister and peel away.
"I am in hell," he decided. "God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
He knew this must be hell, because he was looking at the brand on his chest upside down. And yet, as if by the devil's magic, the word made perfect sense. Fire. Chapter 92. Three ballotings. No pope. Inside the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortati had begun praying for a miracle. "Send us the candidates." The delay had gone long enough. A single missing candidate Mortati could understand, but all four? It left no options. Under these conditions, achieving a two-thirds majority would take an act of God himself. When the bolts on the outer door began to grind open, Mortati and the entire College of Cardinals wheeled in unison toward the entrance. Mortati knew this unsealing could mean only one thing. By law, the chapel door could only be unsealed for two reasons: to remove the very ill, or to admit late cardinals. "The Praeferiti are coming!" Mortati's heart soared. Conclave had been saved. But when the door opened, the gasp that echoed through the chapel was not one of joy. Mortati stared in incredulous shock as the man walked in. For the first time in Vatican history, a Camerlengo had just crossed the sacred threshold of conclave after sealing the doors. What was he thinking? The Camerlengo strode to the altar and turned to address the thunderstruck audience.
"Signore," he said, "I have waited as long as I can. There is something you have a right to know."
Chapter 93. Langdon had no idea where he was going. Reflex was his only compass, driving him away from danger. His elbows and knees burned as he clambered beneath the pews. Still he clawed on. Somewhere a voice was telling him to move left. If you can get to the main aisle, you can dash for the exit. He knew it was impossible. There's a wall of flames blocking the main aisle. His mind hunting for options, Langdon scrambled blindly on. The footsteps closed faster now to his right. When it happened, Langdon was unprepared. He had guessed he had another 10 feet of pews until he reached the front of the church. He had guessed wrong. Without warning, the cover above him ran out. He froze for an instant, half exposed at the front of the church. Rising in the recess to his left, gargantuan from his vantage point, was the very thing that had brought him here. He had entirely forgotten. Bernini's Ecstasy of Saint Teresa rose up like some sort of pornographic still life. The saint on her back arched in pleasure, mouth open in a moan, and over her an angel pointing a spear of fire. A bullet exploded in the pew over Langdon's head. He felt his body rise like a sprinter out of a gate. Fueled only by adrenaline and barely conscious of his actions, he was suddenly running, hunched, head down, pounding across the front of the church to his right. As the bullets erupted behind him, Langdon dove yet again, sliding out of control across the marble floor before crashing in a heap against the railing of a niche on the right-hand wall. It was then that he saw her, a crumpled heap near the back of the church. "Vittoria!"
Her bare legs were twisted beneath her, but Langdon sensed somehow that she was breathing. He had no time to help her. Immediately, the killer rounded the pews on the far left of the church and bore relentlessly down. Langdon knew in a heartbeat it was over. The killer raised the weapon, and Langdon did the only thing he could. He rolled his body over the banister into the niche. As he hit the floor on the other side, the marble columns of the balustrade exploded in a storm of bullets. Langdon felt like a cornered animal as he scrambled deeper into the semicircular niche. Rising before him, the niche's sole contents seemed ironically apropos, a single sarcophagus. Mine, perhaps, Langdon thought. Even the casket itself seemed fitting. It was a scatola, a small, unadorned marble box. Burial on a budget. The casket was raised off the floor on two marble blocks, and Langdon eyed the opening beneath it, wondering if he could slide through. Footsteps echoed behind him. With no other option in sight, Langdon pressed himself to the floor and slithered toward the casket. Grabbing the two marble supports, one with each hand, he pulled like a breaststroke, dragging his torso into the opening beneath the tomb. The gun went off. Accompanying the roar of the gun, Langdon felt a sensation he had never felt in his life, a bullet sailing past his flesh. There was a hiss of wind, like the backlash of a whip, as the bullet just missed him, and exploded in the marble with a puff of dust. Blood surging, Langdon heaved his body the rest of the way beneath the casket. Scrambling across the marble floor, he pulled himself out from beneath the casket and to the other side. Dead end. Langdon was now face to face with the rear wall of the niche. He had no doubt that this tiny space behind the tomb would become his grave. And soon, he realized, as he saw the barrel of the gun appear in the opening beneath the sarcophagus. The Hashashin held the weapon parallel with the floor, pointing directly at Langdon's midsection. Impossible to miss. Langdon felt a trace of self-preservation grip his unconscious mind. He twisted his body into his stomach, parallel with the casket. Face down, he planted his hands flat on the floor, the glass cut from the archives pinching open with a stab. Ignoring the pain, he pushed, driving his body upward in an awkward push-up. Langdon arched his stomach off the floor just as the gun went off. He could feel the shockwave of the bullets as they sailed beneath him and pulverized the porous travertine behind. Closing his eyes and straining against exhaustion, Langdon prayed for the thunder to stop. And then it did. The roar of gunfire was replaced with the cold click of an empty chamber. Langdon opened his eyes slowly, almost fearful his eyelids would make a sound. Fighting the trembling pain, he held his position, arched like a cat. He didn't even dare breathe. His eardrums numbed by gunfire, Langdon listened for any hint of the killer's departure. Silence. He thought of Victoria and ached to help her. The sound that followed was deafening, barely human. A guttural bellow of exertion. The sarcophagus over Langdon's head suddenly seemed to rise on its side. Langdon collapsed on the floor as hundreds of pounds teetered toward him. Gravity overcame friction, and the lid was the first to go, sliding off the tomb and crashing to the floor beside him. The casket came next, rolling off its supports and toppling upside down toward Langdon. As the box rolled, Langdon knew he would either be entombed in the hollow beneath it or crushed by one of the edges. Pulling in his legs and head, Langdon compacted his body and yanked his arms to his sides. Then he closed his eyes and awaited the sickening crush. When it came, the entire floor shook beneath him. The upper rim landed only millimeters from the top of his head, rattling his teeth in their sockets. His right arm, which Langdon had been certain would be crushed, miraculously still felt intact. He opened his eyes to see a shaft of light. The right rim of the casket had not fallen all the way to the floor and was still propped partially on its supports. Directly overhead, though, Langdon found himself staring quite literally into the face of death. The original occupant of the tomb was suspended above him, having adhered, as decaying bodies often did, to the bottom of a casket. The skeleton hovered a moment like a tentative lover, and then with a sticky crackling, it succumbed to gravity and peeled away. The carcass rushed down to embrace him, raining putrid bones and dust into Langdon's eyes and mouth. Before Langdon could react, a blind arm was slithering through the opening beneath the casket, sifting through the carcass like a hungry python. It groped until it found Langdon's neck and clamped down. Langdon tried to fight back against the iron fist now crushing his larynx, but he found his left sleeve pinched beneath the edge of the coffin. He had only one arm free, and the fight was a losing battle. Langdon's legs bent in the only open space he had, his feet searching for the casket floor above him. He found it. Coiling, he planted his feet. Then, as the hand around his neck squeezed tighter, Langdon closed his eyes and extended his legs like a ram. The casket shifted ever so slightly, but enough. With a raw grinding, the sarcophagus slid off the supports and landed on the floor. The casket rim crashed onto the killer's arm, and there was a muffled scream of pain. The hand released Langdon's neck, twisting and jerking away into the dark. When the killer finally pulled his arm free, the casket fell with a conclusive thud against the flat marble floor. Complete darkness. Again. And silence. There was no frustrated pounding outside the overturned sarcophagus. No prying to get in. Nothing. As Langdon lay in the dark amidst a pile of bones, he fought the closing darkness and turned his thoughts to her. "Victoria, are you still alive?" If Langdon had known the truth, the horror to which Victoria would soon awake, he would have wished for her sake that she were dead. Chapter 94. Sitting in the Sistine Chapel among his stunned colleagues, Cardinal Mortati tried to comprehend the words he was hearing. Before him, lit only by the candlelight, the Camerlengo had just told a tale of such hatred and treachery that Mortati found himself trembling. The Camerlengo spoke of kidnapped cardinals, branded cardinals, murdered cardinals. He spoke of the ancient Illuminati, a name that dredged up forgotten fears, and of their resurgence and vow of revenge against the Church. With pain in his voice, the Camerlengo spoke of his late Pope, the victim of an Illuminati poisoning. And finally, his words almost a whisper, he spoke of a deadly new technology, antimatter, which in less than 2 hours threatened to destroy all of Vatican City. When he was through, it was as if Satan himself had sucked the air from the room. Nobody could move. The Camerlengo's words hung in the darkness. The only sound Mortati could now hear was the anomalous hum of a television camera in back, an electronic presence no conclave in history had ever endured, but a presence demanded by the Camerlengo. To the utter astonishment of the cardinals, the Camerlengo had entered the Sistine Chapel with 2 BBC reporters, a man and a woman, and announced that they would be transmitting his solemn statement live to the world. Now speaking directly to the camera, the Camerlengo stepped forward. "To the Illuminati," he said, his voice deepening, "and to those of science, let me say this." He paused. "You have won the war." The silence spread now to the deepest corners of the chapel. Mortati could hear the desperate thumping of his own heart. "The wheels have been in motion for a long time," the Camerlengo said. "Your victory has been inevitable. Never before has it been as obvious as it is at this moment. Science is the new god." "What is he saying?" Mortati thought. "Has he gone mad? The entire world is hearing this." "Medicine, electronic communications, space travel, genetic manipulation,
These are the miracles about which we now tell our children. These are the miracles we herald as proof that science will bring us the answers. The ancient stories of immaculate conceptions, burning bushes, and parting seas are no longer relevant. God has become obsolete. Science has won the battle. We concede. A rustle of confusion and bewilderment swept through the chapel. But science is victory, the Camerlengo added, his voice intensifying, has cost every one of us. And it has cost us deeply. Silence. Science may have alleviated the miseries of disease and drudgery, and provided an array of gadgetry for our entertainment and convenience. But it has left us in a world without wonder. Our sunsets have been reduced to wavelengths and frequencies. The complexities of the universe have been shredded into mathematical equations. Even our self-worth as human beings has been destroyed. Science proclaims that planet Earth and its inhabitants are a meaningless speck in the grand scheme. A cosmic accident. He paused. Even the technology that promises to unite us divides us. Each of us is now electronically connected to the globe, and yet we feel utterly alone. We are bombarded with violence, division, fracture, and betrayal. Skepticism has become a virtue. Cynicism and demand for proof has become enlightened thought. Is it any wonder that humans now feel more depressed and defeated than they have at any point in human history? Does science hold anything sacred? Science looks for answers by probing our unborn fetuses. Science even presumes to rearrange our own DNA. It shatters God's world into smaller and smaller pieces in quest of meaning, and all it finds is more questions. Mortati watched in awe. The Camerlengo was almost hypnotic now. He had a physical strength in his movements and voice that Mortati had never witnessed on a Vatican altar. The man's voice was wrought with conviction and sadness. "The ancient war between science and religion is over," the Camerlengo said. "You have won, but you have not won fairly. You have not won by providing answers. You have won by so radically reorienting our society that the truths we once saw as signposts now seem inapplicable. Religion cannot keep up. Scientific growth is exponential. It feeds on itself like a virus. Every new breakthrough opens doors for new breakthroughs. Mankind took thousands of years to progress from the wheel to the car, yet only decades from the car into space. Now we measure scientific progress in weeks. We are spinning out of control. The rift between us grows deeper and deeper, and as religion is left behind, people find themselves in a spiritual void. We cry out for meaning. And believe me, we do cry out. We see UFOs, engage in channeling, spirit contact, out-of-body experiences, mind quests, all these eccentric ideas of a scientific veneer, but they are unashamedly irrational. They are the desperate cry of the modern soul, lonely and tormented, crippled by its own enlightenment and its inability to accept meaning in anything removed from technology. Mortati could feel himself leaning forward in his seat. He and the other cardinals and people around the world were hanging on this priest's every utterance. The Camerlengo spoke with no rhetoric or vitriol, no references to Scripture or Jesus Christ. He spoke in modern terms, unadorned and pure. Somehow, as though the words were flowing from God himself, he spoke the modern language, delivering the ancient message. In that moment, Mortati saw one of the reasons the late Pope held this young man so dear. In a world of apathy, cynicism, and technological deification, men like the Camerlengo
realists who could speak to our souls like this man just had were the church's only hope. The Camerlengo was talking more forcefully now. Science, you say, will save us. Science, I say, has destroyed us. Since the days of Galileo, the church has tried to slow the relentless march of science, sometimes with misguided means, but always with benevolent intention. Even so, the temptations are too great for man to resist. I warn you, look around yourselves. The promises of science have not been kept. Promises of efficiency and simplicity have bred nothing but pollution and chaos. We are a fractured and frantic species, moving down a path of destruction. The Camerlengo paused a long moment and then sharpened his eyes on the camera. Who is this god, science? Who is the god who offers his people power, but no moral framework to tell you how to use that power? What kind of god gives a child fire, but does not warn the child of its dangers? The language of science comes with no signposts about good and bad. Science textbooks tell us how to create a nuclear reaction. And yet they contain no chapter asking us if it is a good or a bad idea. To science I say this. The church is tired. We are exhausted from trying to be your signposts. Our resources are drying up from our campaign to be the voice of balance as you plow blindly on in your quest for smaller chips and larger profits. We ask not why you will not govern yourselves, but how can you? Your world moves so fast that if you stop even for an instant to consider the implications of your actions, someone more efficient will whip past you in a blur. So you move on. You proliferate weapons of mass destruction. But it is the Pope who travels the world, beseeching leaders to use restraint. You clone living creatures, but it is the Church reminding us to consider the moral implications of our actions. You encourage people to interact on phones, video screens, and computers, but it is the Church who opens its doors and reminds us to commune in person, as we were meant to do. You even murder unborn babies in the name of research that will save lives. Again, it is the Church who points out the fallacy of this reasoning. And all the while you proclaim the Church is ignorant. But who is more ignorant? The man who cannot define lightning? Or the man who does not respect its awesome power? The Church is reaching out to you. Reaching out to everyone. And yet the more we reach, the more you push us away. Show me proof there is a God, you say. I say use your telescopes to look to the heavens and tell me how there could not be a God. The Camerlengo had tears in his eyes now. You ask, what does God look like? I say, where did that question come from? The answers are one and the same. Do you not see God in your science? How can you miss him? You proclaim that even the slightest change in the force of gravity or the weight of an atom would have rendered our universe a lifeless mist rather than our magnificent sea of heavenly bodies. And yet you fail to see God's hand in this? Is it really so much easier to believe that we simply chose the right card from a deck of billions? Have we become so spiritually bankrupt that we would rather believe in mathematical impossibility than in a power greater than us? Whether or not you believe in God, the Camerlengo said, his voice deepening with deliberation, you must believe this. When we, as a species, abandon our trust in the power greater than us, we abandon our sense of accountability. Faith, all faiths, are admonitions that there is something we cannot understand, something to which we are accountable. With faith, we are accountable to each other, to ourselves, to a higher truth. Religion is flawed, but only because man is flawed.
If the outside world could see this church as I do, looking beyond the ritual of these walls, they would see a modern miracle. A brotherhood of imperfect, simple souls wanting only to be a voice of compassion in a world spinning out of control.
The Camerlengo motioned out over the College of Cardinals, and the BBC camerawoman instinctively followed, panning the crowd.
"Are we obsolete?" the Camerlengo asked. "Are these men dinosaurs? Am I? Does the world really need a voice for the poor, the weak, the oppressed, the unborn child? Do we really need souls like these who, though imperfect, spend their lives imploring each of us to read the signposts of morality and not lose our way?"
Mortati now realized that the Camerlengo, whether consciously or not, was making a brilliant move. By showing the cardinals, he was personalizing the church. Vatican City was no longer a building, it was people. People like the Camerlengo who had spent their lives in the service of goodness.
"Tonight, we are perched on a precipice," the Camerlengo said. "None of us can afford to be apathetic. Whether you see this evil as Satan, corruption, or immorality, the dark force is alive and growing every day. Do not ignore it."
The Camerlengo lowered his voice to a whisper as the camera moved in.
"The force, though mighty, is not invincible. Goodness can prevail. Listen to your hearts. Listen to God. Together we can step back from this abyss."
Now Mortati understood. This was the reason. Conclave had been violated, but this was the only way. It was a dramatic and desperate plea for help. The Camerlengo was speaking to both his enemy and his friends now. He was entreating anyone, friend or foe, to see the light and stop this madness. Certainly someone listening would realize the insanity of this plot and come forward. The Camerlengo knelt at the altar.
"Pray with me."
The College of Cardinals dropped to their knees to join him in prayer. Outside in St. Peter's Square, and around the globe, a stunned world knelt with them. Chapter 95. The Hashashin arranged his unconscious trophy in the rear of the van and took a moment to admire her sprawled body. She was not as beautiful as the women he bought, and yet she had an animal strength that excited him. Her body was radiant, dewy with perspiration. She smelled of musk. As the Hashashin stood there savoring his prize, he ignored the throb in his arm. The bruise from the falling sarcophagus, although painful, was insignificant, well worth the compensation that lay before him. He took consolation in knowing the American who had done this to him was probably dead by now. Gazing down at his incapacitated prisoner, the Hashashin visualized what lay ahead. He ran a palm up beneath her shirt. Her breasts felt perfect beneath her bra.
"Yes," he smiled, "you are more than worthy."
Fighting the urge to take her right there, he closed the door and drove off into the night. There was no need to alert the press about this killing. The flames would do that for him. At CERN, Sylvie sat stunned by the Camerlengo's address. Never before had she felt so proud to be a Catholic, and so ashamed to work at CERN. As she left the recreational wing, the mood in every single viewing room was dazed and somber. When she got back to Kohler's office, all 7 phone lines were ringing. Media inquiries were never routed to Kohler's office, so the incoming calls could only be one thing. Geld. Money calls. Antimatter technology already had some takers.
Inside the Vatican, Gunther Glick was walking on air as he followed the Camerlengo from the Sistine Chapel. Glick and Macri had just made the live transmission of the decade. And what a transmission it had been. The Camerlengo had been spellbinding. Now, out in the hallway, the Camerlengo turned to Glick and Macri. "I have asked the Swiss Guard to assemble photos for you. Photos of the branded cardinals, as well as one of his late holiness. I must warn you, these are not pleasant pictures. Ghastly burns, blackened tongues. But I would like you to broadcast them to the world." Glick decided it must be perpetual Christmas inside Vatican City. "He wants me to broadcast an exclusive photo of the dead Pope." "Are you sure?" Glick asked, trying to keep the excitement from his voice. The Camerlengo nodded. "The Swiss Guard will also provide you a live video feed of the antimatter canister as it counts down." Glick stared. "Christmas! Christmas! Christmas!" "The Illuminati are about to find out," the Camerlengo declared, "that they have grossly overplayed their hand." Chapter 96. Like a recurring theme in some demonic symphony, the suffocating darkness had returned. No light, no air, no exit. Langdon lay trapped beneath the overturned sarcophagus and felt his mind careening dangerously close to the brink. Trying to drive his thoughts in any direction other than the crushing space around him, Langdon urged his mind toward some logical process, mathematics, music, anything. But there was no room for calming thoughts. "I can't move. I can't breathe." The pinched sleeve of his jacket had thankfully come free when the casket fell, leaving Langdon now with two mobile arms. Even so, as he pressed upward on the ceiling of his tiny cell, he found it immovable. Oddly, he wished his sleeve were still caught. At least it might create a crack for some air. As Langdon pushed against the roof above, his sleeve fell back to reveal the faint glow of an old friend, Mickey. The greenish cartoon face seemed mocking now. Langdon probed the blackness for any other sign of light, but the casket rim was flush against the floor. "Goddamn Italian perfectionists," he cursed, now imperiled by the same artistic excellence he taught his students to revere. Impeccable edges, faultless parallels, and, of course, use only the most seamless and resilient Carrara marble. Precision can be suffocating. "Lift the damn thing," he said aloud, pressing harder through the tangle of bones. The box shifted slightly. Setting his jaw, he heaved again. The box felt like a boulder, but this time it raised a quarter of an inch. A fleeting glimmer of light surrounded him, and then the casket thudded back down. Langdon lay panting in the dark. He tried to use his legs to lift, as he had before, but now that the sarcophagus had fallen flat, there was no room even to straighten his knees. As the claustrophobic panic closed in, Langdon was overcome by images of the sarcophagus shrinking around him. Squeezed by delirium, he fought the illusion with every logical shred of intellect he had. "Sarcophagus," he stated aloud, with as much academic sterility as he could muster. But even erudition seemed to be his enemy today. "Sarcophagus" is from the Greek sarx, meaning flesh, and phagein, meaning to eat. I'm trapped in a box literally designed to eat flesh. Images of flesh eaten from bone only served as a grim reminder that Langdon lay covered in human remains. The notion brought nausea and chills, but it also brought an idea. Fumbling blindly around the coffin, Langdon found a shard of bone. A rib, maybe? He didn't care. All he wanted was a wedge. If he could lift the box, even a crack, and slide the bone fragment beneath the rim, then maybe enough air could... Reaching across his body and wedging the tapered end of the bone into the crack between the floor and coffin, Langdon reached up with his other hand and heaved skyward. The box didn't move, not even slightly. He tried again.
For a moment it seemed to tremble slightly, but that was all. With a fetid stench and lack of oxygen choking the strength from his body, Langdon realized he only had time for one more effort. He also knew he would need both arms. Regrouping, he placed the tapered edge of the bone against the crack, and shifting his body, he wedged the bone against his shoulder, pinning it in place. Careful not to dislodge it, he raised both hands above him. As the stifling confine began to smother him, he felt a welling of intensified panic. It was the second time today he had been trapped with no air. Hollering aloud, Langdon thrust upward in one explosive motion. The casket jostled off the floor for an instant, but long enough. The bone shard he had braced against his shoulders slipped outward into the widening crack. When the casket fell again, the bone shattered, but this time Langdon could see the casket was propped up. A tiny slit of light showed beneath the rim. Exhausted, Langdon collapsed. Hoping the strangling sensation in his throat would pass, he waited, but it only worsened as the seconds passed. Whatever air was coming through the slit seemed imperceptible. Langdon wondered if it would be enough to keep him alive, and if so, for how long. If he passed out, who would know he was even in there? With arms like lead, Langdon raised his watch again. 10:12 p.m. Fighting trembling fingers, he fumbled with the watch and made his final play. He twisted one of the tiny dials and pressed a button. As consciousness faded and the walls squeezed closer, Langdon felt the old fears sweep over him. He tried to imagine, as he had so many times, that he was in an open field. The image he conjured, however, was no help. The nightmare that had haunted him since his youth came crashing back. "The flowers here are like paintings," the child thought, laughing as he ran across the meadow. He wished his parents had come along, but his parents were busy pitching camp. "Don't explore too far," his mother had said. He had pretended not to hear as he bounded off into the woods. Now, traversing this glorious field, the boy came across a pile of field stones. He figured it must be the foundation of an old homestead. He would not go near it. He knew better. Besides, his eyes had been drawn to something else, a brilliant lady's slipper, the rarest and most beautiful flower in New Hampshire. He had only ever seen them in books. Excited, the boy moved toward the flower. He knelt down. The ground beneath him felt mulchy and hollow. He realized this flower had found an extra fertile spot. It was growing from a patch of rotting wood. Thrilled by the thought of taking home his prize, the boy reached out, fingers extending toward the stem. He never reached it. With a sickening crack, the earth gave way. In 3 seconds of dizzying terror as he fell, the boy knew he would die. Plummeting downward, he braced for the bone-crushing collision. When it came, there was no pain, only softness and cold. He hit the deep liquid face first, plunging into a narrow blackness. Spinning disoriented somersaults, he groped the sheer walls that enclosed him on all sides. Somehow, as if by instinct, he sputtered to the surface. Light, faint, above him. Miles above him, it seemed. His arms clawed at the water, searching the walls of the hollow for something to grab onto. Only smooth stone. He had fallen through an abandoned well covering. He screamed for help, but his cries reverberated in the tight shaft. He called out again and again. Above him, the tattered hole grew dim. Night fell. Time seemed to contort in the darkness. Numbness set in as he treaded water in the depths of the chasm, calling, crying out. He was tormented by visions of the walls collapsing in, burying him alive. His arms ached with fatigue. A few times he thought he heard voices. He shouted out, but his own voice was muted, like a dream. As the night wore on, the shaft deepened. The walls inched quietly inward.
The boy pressed out against the enclosure, pushing it away. Exhausted, he wanted to give up, and yet he felt the water buoy him, cooling his burning fears until he was numb. When the rescue team arrived, they found the boy barely conscious. He had been treading water for 5 hours. 2 days later, the Boston Globe ran a front-page story called The Little Swimmer That Could.